Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with new guidelines issued by the Department of Justice that emphasize the prosecution of individual executives in white-collar crime over going after the corporation. Russell McIver, the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter and author of On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy, joins us to discuss whether these new rules will name and shame corporate criminals and how much they are a response to widespread criticism that the Obama administration has not put on trial or jailed any senior Wall Street executive responsible for the 2008 crash that cost the economy $13 trillion and wiped out $9 trillion in home equity. Then we'll examine the politics of Hungary to try to understand why the country is behaving so badly in its treatment of refugees, particularly since after the 1956 Hungarian revolt, the countries that are welcoming refugees fleeing from mistreatment in Hungary today were the same countries that took in Hungarian refugees fleeing the brutal Soviet crackdown that crushed the 1956 uprising by Hungarians demanding freedom. Charles Gatti, a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, joins us to discuss Hungary's own refugee crisis, where up to 700,000 Hungarians have been purged by Viktor Orban's right-wing regime, which has an even more virulent neo-Nazi party, Jobbik, challenging it on the right. Then finally, we will speak with Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog and the author of The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. He joins us to explain how gangs of oil company lobbyists were able to buy off enough junior Democratic legislators in the California State House to scuttle Governor Brown's and the leadership's groundbreaking efforts to have petroleum use cut by 50%. In vehicles in California by 2030. And joining us now is Russell McIver, who is the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Russell McIver.
Thank you, Ian.
And there has been a statement from the Justice Department. They've issued new guidelines that emphasize prosecuting individual executives in white-collar crime cases and not just their corporations. This sort of strikes me as a sort of, you know, day late and a dollar short.
When you speak with corporate criminal defense attorneys, and we interview them at least once a month, sometimes a couple times a month, or Corporate Crime Reporter, which is our legal weekly newsletter, what they tell you is the thing that their clients, the big, large, multinational corporations, fear most is to be branded as a criminal. So these are companies that have engaged in criminal wrongdoing, but they don't want to be branded as a criminal. They want special treatment, and they've been given special treatment over the last 10 years. And this special treatment comes in the form of what are called deferred and non-prosecution agreements. Deferred non-prosecution agreements were originally intended for individuals like you and I, first offense, minor drug offense, to clear the deck of these minor cases. And it says, we will charge you with a minor crime, and if you're a good boy or girl for a year and don't get into further trouble, we'll drop the charge so you won't have a record. And they've been used across the country for that up until 15 years ago or so when the corporate crime lobby came up with this idea, hey, let's use this to insulate ourselves from being labeled as corporate criminals. And that's what's been happening. Prior to the Arthur Andersen case, The corporations that engaged in criminal activity were forced to plead guilty, and they were publicly shamed as corporate criminals. Then, 15 years ago, they started getting these deferred and non-prosecution agreements where they were charged with crimes. They paid these fines, and then after a period of years, usually 2 or 3 years with some conditions, if they abide by the agreement, the charges are dropped, and there's no record of criminality. Now, what's happened since is that there have been criticisms of this process from one side saying, hey, How can you charge a company with a crime if you don't charge an individual? If you're going to bring these deferred non-prosecution agreements, charge individuals also. But there's another side that argues, hey, why are they getting these special plea deals? Forget about the individuals for a second. If you're focusing on corporate criminal liability and you come to the determination that they've engaged in criminal wrongdoing, then charge the company with a crime and force them to plead guilty or take it to trial. Let's hear about what happened. Instead, what the Justice Department is doing is they're keeping in place the deferred non-prosecution agreement, and they've released a memo today saying, hey, if you want one of these special deals, you're going to have to tell us about executives. Well, that's always been the case. So I see this as pretty much public relations as usual. There's a little bit of tweak in policy where they're saying if you want cooperation credit to get these deals, you're going to have to tell us about executives who engaged in wrongdoing. But often what happens is the company lawyers and the Justice Department prosecutors get together and say, this is the deal we want for the company. And to get there, if we have to throw some lower-level executives under the bus, we will. Even some middle-managing executives, we will. But no corporate executive, no C-suite executive, corporate suite executive, is going to say, hey, come get me in exchange for a deferred prosecution agreement. Not going to happen. That's why it's important for the Justice Department to crack down first on corporate crime. And all people who engage in crime ought to be brought to justice, including executives. We're not saying that executives ought not to be brought to justice, but we're worried that this is a fig leaf cover for the corporate, for the corporation, for the C-suite executives, and for their attorneys who are negotiating with the prosecutors.
And again, I'm speaking with Russell Pachyba, who is the editor of The Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. But it's been pretty clear, Russell, that since the 2008 financial crash and the ensuing Great Recession, that cost the economy about $13 trillion and destroyed about $9 trillion in home equity, that almost nobody has gone to jail. And
well, it's not just that. No large financial institution has been criminally prosecuted.
And
so there's no large financial institution criminally prosecuted, no CEO or executive from those companies been criminally prosecuted.
So do you think that this memo today, in effect, is an admission that the DOJ's policy on Wall Street corporate crime has been completely ineffective?
No, it's an admission that there's been a lot of criticism about it. They're feeling the heat, and they have to do something. And what they've done is put out a piece of paper telling their prosecutors, hey, when you negotiate with the corporations, they're not going to get cooperation credit unless they help us get the individuals. Well, this has been going on all along. The corporate defense lawyer is working for the board of directors and for the executive suite. And those are the people calling the shots for the corporation. And the corporation is not going to, those people aren't going to say, come get me, I did it. They're going to say, go get that guy, the vice president in charge of going to jail, or the lower level executives. Now, the only way it will change is if the Justice Department takes these criminal prosecutions seriously, goes after the company, and they're going to have to take these to trial. The companies aren't going to agree to them. Goes after the company, force guilty pleas, impose probation, and toss out the guilty parties. You know, the probation officer will have the authority to do that. Once you start seeing that, then you'll say, okay, these people are serious about the corporate crime wave that's wrecked the economy. But I'm really fearful, given the revolving door, where the budget constraints on the Justice Department, where these people are coming and going from, back into the corporate criminal defense law firms, back then into the Justice Department. It doesn't bode well for a robust program to crack down on corporate crime.
So then there isn't any kind of shift then in the Justice Department, to your mind, with the ascension of Attorney General Loretta Lynch, who took office in April, replacing Eric Holder?
Absolutely not. And in fact, she was involved with some of these dirty deals, some of these deferred prosecution agreements, when she was a U.S. attorney up in New York. And so I see this as just more of the same. What would have been different? What would have been different if she announced, we're no longer going to do these deferred non-prosecution agreements for corporations? And if this memo was paired with a memo on deferred non-prosecution agreements saying, these haven't worked, they failed, they've given the green light to corporate criminals all around the country, then we could celebrate and say, this is a change of pace, now they're serious. But this alone doesn't do it. This alone basically says, unless we see otherwise, this alone basically says, continue the green light, give them what they want. So I don't see a major sea change here. It's being promoted that way, but there's a split within academia on this also. Professor Sam Buell, who's a Duke Law University professor, coming out with a book at the end of this year. University of Virginia Law Professor Brandon Garrett, who wrote a book called Too Big to Jail. They have serious doubts about this also. There are other academics who are more to the right in the corporate crime arena who, for example, are sponsoring this speech today by the Assistant Attorney General announcing this memo. So there's a split within academia over it, and it mirrors the split in Washington in the battle between the corporate crime lobby and those who want to bring the corporate criminals to justice.
And what about the Supreme Court, in the sense that the Supreme Court's reversal of conviction against the accounting firm Arthur Andersen in the Enron scandal and the federal court's rejection of the KPMG employees' prosecution linked to tax shelters? That, my understanding, according to the New York Times article, had a chilling effect on the ability to put these corporate criminals in jail.
Well, these aren't easy cases to prosecute. And after 9/11, the Justice Department lost a lot of resources that were shifted away from corporate crime to terrorism prosecutions. And so resources is a big issue. If there were the resources to pursue these cases, to bring these prosecutions to trial, which are resource intensive when you go to trial, then we might have had a different outcome. But no, those rulings alone did not send a chilling effect. In fact, what happened was, because Arthur Andersen, when people go back and look at it, Arthur Andersen was offered a deferred one of the first deferred prosecution agreements, and they turned it down and decided to go to trial and lost. And then the case was reversed, the conviction was reversed by the Supreme Court. But the reality is that the corporate criminal defense lawyers saw that as their opportunity to shift policy, and they effectively did. Up until then, major companies were regularly pleading guilty to their crimes. And it's not as if in these deferred non-prosecution agreements, it's not as if these aren't crimes. Everybody admits the crimes. The statement of facts that accompany the deferred prosecution agreements lay out criminal activity. It's just that they're special deals. We're not going to force you to admit to criminal activity. And this is not just the Justice Department. The SEC has been doing this for 30 years. I wrote my law school thesis on it. It's called neither admit nor deny consent decrees. So the SEC brings civil cases against major companies, and instead forcing them to admit to wrongdoing, they allow them to agree to this clause where they neither admit nor deny wrongdoing, but agree never to violate the law again, and then they come back and do it anyway. So anybody who's serious about cracking down on crime, any kind of crime, is that you have to admit that shaming works, and the powerful effect of the criminal law is that you want to shame these companies, brand them the criminals that they are, and discourage them from engaging in that kind of behavior.
And what part does the infamous Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad decision back in the Gilded Age that made corporations persons in law, does that play a role here? In other words, there's no such person as Mr. Goldman Sachs or Mr. J.P. Morgan Chase or Mr. General Electric. So how do you put them in jail?
Well, you can't put them in jail. It's a fiction, but it's a fiction that we've come to accept. Maybe we shouldn't accept it, but we have come to accept it. And that's the basis of corporate criminal liability. There are right-wing academics who argue that because a corporation is a person, because a corporation doesn't have a mind, it can't commit crime. And, you know, the famous saying, no mind, no crime. You can't decide that you're going to intend to engage in criminal activity if you don't have a mind. You know, based on that, they've sought to toss corporate criminal liability. But unless we toss personhood across the board, it becomes really dangerous to selectively toss personhood, to say that a corporation has a First Amendment right to induce young children to smoke cigarettes. But it's not a person when it comes to criminal prosecution.
Well, it does seem that the deck is rigged. And basically what you're telling us, Russell McCubbin, is that the so-called good news coming out of the New York Times story where they got this memo from the Justice Department that was saying that the Justice Department had issued new guidelines emphasizing prosecuting individual executives in white-collar crime cases and not just their corporations. And the idea that all this money's been paid out and nobody's gone to jail, that's going to continue? That this is just a sort of, in effect, raising false hopes? Is that
unless we see more, unless there's another shoe that's going to drop on the deferred non-prosecution front, that's right what you're saying. Don't believe the hype. And for a different view, check out corporatecrimereporter.com and also every morning, a morning podcast with a different take, a one-minute take called the Corporate Crime Reporter Minute, which is available at corporatecrimereporter.com. So to get a different view from the New York Times on the reality of corporate criminal prosecutions in America, check out corporatecrimereporter.com and the Corporate Crime Reporter Minute.
Well, just in closing then, just to broaden the landscape out here a little bit, is this really, at the end of the day, to do with, as far as I know, looking back on the last couple of centuries of our history, there have been two power centers in the United States, Washington, D.C., and Wall Street. And it does seem that for most of the last couple of hundred years, Washington, D.C. has been the main power center. But lately, it does seem that Wall Street has become the dominant power center. Is that what's happening here in the broader sense?
Well, there's a famous statue outside of the Federal Trade Commission in downtown Washington, and it's this huge workhorse that's bolting and being restrained by a very muscular farmer. And this was out of the New Deal, where the idea was that Wall Street couldn't be left unrestrained, that there had to be a public entity to restrain it. Otherwise, it would run amok and destroy the society. So that's been a constant battle. Over the last 20 years, there's almost unanimous opinion that Wall Street has dominated Washington, marinated Washington with thousands of lobbyists and millions of dollars in campaign contributions, and weakened the restraint on the market. But I think now across the globe, we're seeing the rise of a politics urging more restraint, urging, you know, everybody agrees that, you know, we can't live without stop signs and red lights and green lights and caution lights. We need that not only in our own communities, but over Wall Street. Otherwise, we're going to see a repeat of 2008.
But as long as money dominates our politics and our politicians are telemarketers who spend most of their days asking for money, Wall Street has had more money than anybody else. So it's not surprising that Wall Street has been able to buy most of our politicians.
It's not surprising, but it's also increasingly being used by an excuse by the citizenry not to engage. I think you're seeing that starting to change, where there are people across the United States, people are saying, you know, no matter what the situation now, we have to stand up. We have to rise up and speak out against excessive greed and corporate power, and that's what's happening. So they're not saying there's nothing we can do, money controls. They say we have to become active and push back on not just the money front, but across all these issues.
Well, Russell McIver, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Russell McIver, who is the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the politics of Hungary to try to understand why the country is behaving so badly in its treatment of refugees. And you know that there's a place in the sun for all that you've done, for you and your children. Yeah, you already know how this will end.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for leather, each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Gatti, who is a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the United States Department of State and a former professor at Union College and Columbia University. His books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zbigniew, the Strategy and Statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Gatti.
Thanks a lot.
And Hungary is certainly getting a black eye in terms of global opinion, I think, for its treatment of the refugee crisis in Europe. There's nothing more powerful, I think, than the contrasting images. For example, on Thursday's front page of the New York Times, there's a picture of a German woman putting a jacket on a young African refugee boy. And you compare that to the footage of the Hungarian camera woman kicking a woman and child and tripping a refugee father with his child in arms who was escaping the police. Those are pretty grim images from Hungary. And do you think it accurately reflects the politics of that country?
Well, to a great extent, yes. But I would like to mention to you that in Hungary, too, there have been many, many expressions of kindness towards the migrants and refugees. People would bring food and blankets and even carts for little kids and games and so on the long march from Budapest to the Austrian border. I myself saw on Hungarian television how people were giving water to the to those who were walking there, and brought many other things there as well. So it's not one-sided. It is the Hungarian government that gets the negative attention, and I believe that that is correctly so.
And the Hungarian government, as right-wing as Viktor Orbán is, he has an even more virulent right-wing party to his right flank, right? The Jobbik Party?
Well, yeah, it pronounces Jobbik. It is, you are absolutely right. And I believe that this is the primary reason why he has been as confrontational with the European Union and the West in general, and why he has allowed the mistreatment of these refugees. For if he doesn't do that, then a good chunk of his support, voting support, would go to Jobbik still further to his right. So this is a domestic political game that's a very cruel game that we see on display here.
But not to let Viktor Orbán off the hook. My understanding is that he runs a very ruthless kind of regime that has purged throughout the bureaucracies in Hungary and, you know, throughout the country itself. He has purged the country and the bureaucracies of political opponents, anybody that's considered too liberal. There's been an exodus, if you will, a brain drain. 700,000 Hungarians have left recently for Western Europe. So is this what's going on, that there's a kind of right-wing purge going on in that country?
Well, yes, I think that is about right, and your number is about right. I also hear the number 500,000 that under Orbán's time as prime minister has left for the West, many of them to have gone to London. And so for your audience, let me say that if it's just because I just did this back of the envelope calculation, that the 500,000 Hungarians leaving their country for the West would be the same, or is the same, as if 16 million Americans would leave the United States. That's when you begin to understand what an extraordinary set of events we are witnessing in and around Hungary, but several other countries as well.
And could you describe this exodus as a brain drain?
Well, yes, I think you could say that. It is. It obviously has, like the collection of migrants and refugees coming to Europe, has two components. Some of them leave because the political pressures are such essentially a one-man show under Orbán that they don't want to live there. But others just simply want to live better or cannot find work. I don't know how many are one way or the other, but it is certainly a dissatisfaction with Orbán's Hungary that has prompted these people to leave.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Gatti, who's a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the United States Department of State and a former professor at Union College and Columbia University. His books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zbigniew, The Strategy and Statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski. Now, in terms of the 1956 that you've written about in Failed Illusions, of course, there was a huge exodus of Hungarian refugees escaping the Soviet crackdown on the 1956 rebellion in Hungary. So that's sort of, isn't that also a little bit ironic that Hungarian refugees were welcomed into Austria and now you have a kind of situation of refugees from the Middle East, you know, fleeing through Hungary into the more hospitable arms of the Austrians?
Well, it's not only ironic, it is disgusting when you think through that the outside world was so kind to Hungarians a couple of generations ago and on smaller occasions ever since. And yet this Hungarian government forgets that experience and treats foreigners in the way that they have, with a barbed wire, and then, as you mentioned in your introduction, now the army has moved down there to keep them out rather than to welcome them in. So it is a very upsetting development that for which I think Hungary is going to pay a price. Certainly, its reputation, as you also mentioned, could not be worse. And what domestic consequences there will be for Orbán and his party remains to be seen, but there will be some.
Well, Orbán has already made a kind of an alliance with Vladimir Putin, has he not? I don't know how much money's exchanged hands, but he seems to be almost a bridgehead for Putin in Europe.
Well, if you are given to conspiracy theories, which in this case I would not be, but I have certainly heard this. There are people who believe that Orbán is doing Putin's bidding when he is trying to undermine the unity and cohesiveness of the European Union. There is a similarity between the two leaders and how they proceed in their countries. For example, both consider NGOs, which is to say non-governmental organizations, some of them supported by foreign donors, consider them attempts by foreign countries to undermine them and to overthrow their respective regimes. So there are many other similarities as well. And of course, it's important to keep in mind that while Hungary in the EU did vote behind the scenes for sanctions last year against Russia on account of its invasion of Ukraine and taking of Crimea, but the vote behind the scenes was has been countered by an extraordinary campaign against Ukraine and not against Russia. So it's a curious position somewhere between East and West that Orbán has come to occupy.
Well, I think that one of the reasons why there's a lot of outrage expressed towards Hungary's treatment of the refugees is quite simply that the refugees don't want to stay in Hungary. They simply want to get to Austria and then on to Germany. So why mistreat these people? That's the part of it that's never made any sense.
Well, that issue is actually quite complicated because the rules in the European Union, very complicated rules, initially did not allow Hungary to just let these people go on because of the requirement of registration. And so the refugees did not want to be registered because they feared that if they did, then the Hungarians will insist that they stay there. It's even more complicated than this, but the problem is that the European Union was not prepared, either institutionally or in any other way, for this invasion from the outside. Its borders are open, but I think in the future some border controls, not only external border controls, will have to be strengthened. Everybody knows and that they are there, but some of the internal controls will have to be returned, so that people who live in the European Union, who are citizens of the European Union, could move freely back and forth. But that this would not apply to others. It's a complicated kind of thing. That there is, but the union's rules stood in the way of doing some of the things that the Hungarians wanted to do.
So what do you hear from Hungary, Charles Gatti, you know, even anecdotally, in terms of how they're reacting to how they're being perceived in the world because of the news coverage of their treatment of these refugees?
Well, that depends on who you listen to, but I think there is some understanding of the criticisms. But don't forget that nationalism, being as embedded in the Hungarian political scene these days, excessive criticisms here, including from myself, are also resented. And so it's very difficult to play this game right, because if you don't criticize them for what they are doing, then you are in the process of appeasement. If you do, you may find yourself strengthening the support behind the government. So this is a time for diplomats to handle the issues with great care, firmness, but with great care.
But when you talk of Hungarian nationalism, what are we talking about? The nationalism of Jobbik, which is going after the gypsies and now the refugees? Or what is the essence of Hungarian nationalism?
Well, the essence of that, reduced to truly to the basics, is where Jobbik and Orbán's party, called Fidesz, do agree, and their supporters agree, which is that Hungary is for the Hungarians. which is to say they are suspicious of foreigners, they are suspicious of multinational companies, they are suspicious of foreign banks, and essentially most of them, perhaps not all of them, believe that the world is anti-Hungarian. I know this sounds ridiculous because it assumes that the outside world really pays attention and cares one way or the other, but I think a very large number of Hungarian nationalists believe that that the West has nothing good to offer. After all, if you want to, you want me to go through this argument, they claim that after World War One, for example, Hungary lost 2/3 of its territory, and that was a Western result of the Paris Peace Accords. That after World War II, the West did not care that the Soviet Union occupied Hungary and imposed communism in 1956. Nobody came to Hungary's assistance, certainly not militarily. In 1989, Hungary opened the first border between the West and the communist world, the Austro-Hungarian border, in the fall, and yet they claim they have not benefited or nobody has been particularly grateful for that. Sure, there is a long, long list. I just gave you a taste of that short list. There is a long list of feeling that they've been abandoned and betrayed, and therefore they should not rely on anybody else but themselves.
Well, Charles Gaddy, I thank you very much for filling us in on this unfortunate story.
Well, thank you for calling. Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you again. And I've been speaking with Charles Gaddy, who's a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the United States Department of State and a former professor at Union College and Columbia University. And his books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zbigniew, the Strategy and Statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how oil company lobbyists scuttled Governor Brown's groundbreaking efforts to have petroleum use cut by 50% in vehicles in California by 2030.
Get from out the road when you get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, invest. The 10K, so cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumping, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he about to change the price again. It go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. It won't stop top billing till he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's the co-author of Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health, and his latest book, The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit, has just come out. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Court.
My pleasure.
And California has dropped its plans to halve petroleum use in vehicles by 2013 after intense oil industry lobbying. And if this was a part of a climate change legislation bill, and they've dropped this provision. So clearly, this is a victory for big oil here in the state of California. And it has implications for the nation because California is seen as the leader on climate change, and presumably this is a blow to the country and the world, or at least those that care about the future of the planet.
Yeah, and in particularly the world, because Governor Brown had hoped to walk into a UN talks in Paris on new global warming standards with some kind of commitment legislatively that we'd reduce our petroleum use in California in half in 15 years, which, frankly, given the proliferation of EV vehicles at longer ranges that's going to come online in the next 5 to 10 years, with alternative fuels, non-fossil fuels that can be used in corporate and government fleets, I mean, it could be done. But what's really shocking is that you have, you know, the commitment of the top legislative leaders who are Democrats in the state capitol. You got Governor Brown, the head of the Senate, Kevin DeLeon, Tony Atkins, you know, all pushing really hard on this. And the oil industry managed to take a couple of junior members of the party in the assembly and clog up the works. And that is really amazing that, you know, the fossil fuel purveyors could capture this kind of landmark legislation in a Democratic-dominated institution. And it goes right to the heart of a lot of the old problems with Sacramento politics that we've faced with every big battle against every special interest group. And they do need to be remedied if big oil is going to be made smaller, because we have, you know, a real chance for round two, either in a special session. The governor and De Leon seem committed, and they said they've only intensified their commitment. There's a ballot measure possibility here. And you know, there's also the legislature reconvening in January. Things have to be a little bit more serious this time, though. You know, there's a lot of backdoor, backroom talks. Some activists wanted to go after the assembly members who are sticking by big oil, had taken their money and mentioned their money. There's a real sentiment here that that you know, we can get this done and we can do it, you know, with handshakes, and they won't let the activists really let loose on the oil industry contributions to these assembly members, to play hardball, to, you know, put them on the spot. There wasn't even a vote, you know, in the assembly to see who was with the oil industry and who was with the public. And that, you can't play softball when you're dealing with the most dangerous and deceitful industry in the world. And then, you know, to I think, you know, if you're in the legislature, you have to also acknowledge that, you know, cost is an issue here. And what the oil industry did was, you know, tell these assembly members costs for gas are going to be higher in their district if this legislation, SB 350, passed. And in fact, the opposite's true. I mean, economists, oil traders, consumer advocates like me will tell you, if you cut the demand for petroleum and you therefore free up supply for petroleum, you will drive down prices. And we are being gouged. We've talked about this before. I think last time I was here, you know, we're paying a buck more than the rest of the nation in California for our gas because we have low inventories. And these four oil refiners that have control of 78% of the market keep gouging us. This was a perfect opportunity to take on the gouging and the cost issue, and even take on some ideas we had floated about forcing the refiners to be more open and transparent. And that was not something that the legislative leadership or the governor did. And they got to do that in round two if we're going to win this fight. And I think they will, and I think we will.
And of course, oil now is at an all-time, not an all-time low, but certainly for the last few years, it's below $40 a barrel, and that in no way is reflected in the price of gasoline in California. And the Exxon refinery is still down from a fire, and the two Texas refiners here in the state of California have been deliberately taking their plants down for maintenance to create these artificial shortages in order to run the prices up. So we talked about that last time, and you'd think now, as with the oil prices at such a low and reflected across the country, but not in California, what's wrong with our public? I mean, why aren't they up in arms?
Well, they are. They're pissed, but they also don't know necessarily that. You know, at $4 a gallon or below $4 a gallon, we're so different from the rest of the country. I mean, if you travel, you do. You know, people are used to paying around $4, but they know they're getting gouged, and they have on and off. And the reality is they just don't know what to do about it. They've accepted it. You know, it's Stockholm Syndrome. Right. we've always been the punching bags for the oil industry. But even the guy who's a free market economist in Berkeley, who I often fight with over oil prices over the last 15 years and gas prices, who claimed, you know, the free market works, and he just took control of the California Energy Commission Petroleum Market Advisory Committee today. This is the governor's committee to look into gas prices, acknowledged in his press release, literally says, something's wrong here. It's costing consumers millions of dollars a day. Taxes and environmental policy don't come anywhere near explaining this dollar difference. So even the free market economists like know something's sour. The question is, what do you do about it? I was fortunate enough to air a proposal with the founder of NextGen Climate, Tom Steyer, and we're considering a ballot measure right now that would for November 2016 that would require the oil refiners to have a plan to keep sufficient inventories, to open their books, justify their profits, justify their supplies, get permission if they want the refiners to go down, tell us when they're going to come back up. Because what happened with Exxon Torrance was it went down, and that was mid-February. Prices went through the roof. We had, you know, some imports finally coming in May and June. The oil refiners found a way to jack up prices artificially at their gas stations. But everyone expected that July 1, Exxon Torrance would be back online. And guess what? We learned July 1, it's not going to be back online until the fall. And that's when prices in Southern California, despite these low crude oils, went literally $4 a gallon. If we had known that in a market, we would have imported. All the imports stopped on July 1 because everyone thought Exxon Torrance was gonna come back. And it didn't. And they had no obligation to tell the state or to tell the public or to tell the markets. So if we just knew when refineries were going down, when they were going to come up, you know, the market would work to some degree to backfill because there's money to be made on gasoline. People can import it. But when we have, you know, these four big refineries that control 78% of the market, keep us in the dark, you know, we can't have any way of compensating. And so a simple proposal like that at the ballot would probably do very well. It might even be in conjunction with a proposal that the governor, I think, is now considering putting on the ballot to create a 15-year goal of reducing petroleum by 50%, which, again, I really think is doable. A lot more doable than going to the moon when they said they were going to go to the moon and didn't know how they were going to get there. You know, I think this is really now a moment where big oil, by so visibly foiling efforts in Sacramento, has made itself public enemy number one with the governor, with Senator De Leon. There's a new speaker coming into the assembly, Anthony Rendon, who is a yes vote. I assume he's angry, as the old speaker is, Tony Atkins. And that gives us a little bit more power to go after big oil on the price side. They've got to be really, really frustrated because I've been hearing for 2 weeks, stand down, don't say anything, we've got the votes, you're going to piss people off. I mean, literally, that's what every activist has been hearing for 2 weeks. And, you know, when the people carrying the legislation say that, that's what you do. But the reality is they didn't have the votes. They should have known all along that they had to play hardball with the assembly members that are responsible for this roadblock. And those assembly members should pay a price, frankly, in the next election.
And again, I'm speaking with Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's the co-author of Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health, and his latest book, The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit, is now available. Now, let me start with the press, because yesterday I was listening to the coverage from the local NPR on what's happening with these bills up in Sacramento, in particular the 50% cut in gasoline consumption in the state of California by 2030. There was no mention of oil industry lobbying in this coverage. It was like they were deliberately going out of their way to avoid the 900-pound gorilla in the room. So certainly there's a lack of press letting the public know about what's behind both efforts to scuttle climate change legislation and also efforts to find out why the price of gasoline in California is higher than anywhere else in the country at a time when crude oil is at below $40 a barrel. So about naming and shaming these assembly members who got bought off by the oil companies. You say they didn't take a vote. I mean, Henry Pereira, I guess, from Democrat of Fresno, was the most visible one. Is there any way to put together a ledger and name and shame these people so that they can get voted out next time?
Sure, it would have been easier if they put them to a vote, but I think we can.
Uh-huh.
There were 20 assembly members of the 80-person House who refused to vote either yay or nay on a bill by Fran Pavley a couple of days ago that was creating a renewable portfolio standard that was very, very high. So they're the same people. And I think by assembling that list and other information, we can put together a list of these assembly members. You know, I think the bigger problem is that the legislative leaders and the governor have to deal with this cost crisis that I think the public is very up in arms about, it from the opinion research that I've been seeing. You know, we have, like, you know, 70% plus worried about being gouged and knowing they're being gouged in support of the type of solutions we have. And I think there has to be a recognition that, yes, we got to punish the people who didn't vote and we got to get them in line, but also we've got to engage the public right where they are, which is really angry about oil companies. Now, the oil company ads that were very prevalent in rural districts and these assembly member districts, but they're also, you know, all over these conservative radio stations. I don't think they do much for the public when, you know, big oil's paying for them. And I don't know how that and a fleet of lobbyists, which big oil did assemble and set loose on the Capitol, could really overcome senior leaders of the Democratic Party who could have talked to those younger assembly members and showed them the way. I mean, instead of those types of talks, we had Halle Berry hanging with one of these guys from Elk Grove, who said he was worried about the legislation, worried about the costs of it. I mean, the costs are a big bugaboo. There was a widespread misinformation campaign by oil companies is going to drive up costs at the pump. The only way that's possible, because if you take away half the gas supply, you are freeing more of the gas supply, and gas is scarce here. So the only way that happens is if the government imposes really stiff taxes or some kind of penalties, and that's just not going to happen because you could even legislate against that happening. And the Air Resources Board isn't empowered to issue new taxes. So I don't really quite understand how that narrative was allowed to exist without people in the know saying, you know, that's just garbage. You want to have a real reason to object, tell me it's because you're taking money from big oil and you don't believe in climate change. But don't talk about costs at the pump, because this is going to help costs at the pump. And we didn't have that frank kind of narrative. And I think if legislative leaders started talking that frankly, you know, with those assembly members and with the public and with the media, and they start to go after the real causes of the gouge, which we know are very high profits, world record profits from the oil refiners for the last 2 months. That says everything off their refining in California. If we start to do that and we have a spotlight like the governor doing that, I don't think the oil companies get away with anything. But that didn't happen.
Well, given that Governor Brown has pledged to move ahead, and obviously this has been a big blow to him ahead of his expected attendance at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris in November, and unfortunately, because California has the reputation both in the country and around the world as the sort of trendsetter in politics and political and social change, there is clearly a huge blow here. But given that that the two remaining components of the climate change bill are still happening, the increase of renewable energy, renewable electricity use, and improving energy efficiency in buildings, what about another way to attack the gasoline consumption? Because can't you make the case that gasoline and the effects it's having on the world and on California is so detrimental that surely, could you go the route of attacking big tobacco? In other words, big tobacco has essentially been taxed, not out of existence, but it's been taxed to the point where it's discouraged a greater use amongst teenagers in particular. So I know that politicians are completely gutless about taxes, but could you at least start that in the public consciousness that, you know, just as we have an alcohol and tobacco tax to discourage socially destructive products, can't we put oil in that category as a socially destructive product?
Yes. In fact, I think that's something that has already, you know, been in the narrative anyway. How we do that in the law still takes the legislature. I think that we are really, you know, in a place where the gestalt acknowledges the dangers of the fossil fuel economy. The technology is there for EV vehicles to be really having much longer battery ranges with a lot cheaper price tags. And I don't think if you study this problem anyway, you can deny that it's going to be cheaper and cleaner energy if we get away from fossil fuels and petroleum, because even when crude is below $4 or $4 a barrel, we still have $4 gas in California. It's the consolidation that's the problem with the market. And so I just think this is not a fact-based mission, and it was really a communications problem to some degree in Sacramento, and a problem with the way that Sacramento usually does businesses, which is as a club, you know, and inside a building where, you have respect for the biggest donors and the biggest lobbyists, and the biggest donors and the biggest lobbyists are among the two top donors of the oil industry. They're right after pharmaceutical, and big oil lobbyists spend more money lobbying this year than anyone else. So, you know, there's a lot of cross pollination between government and these industries, but the governor can get above it. Senator De Leon can get above it. They really tried, and I think they're committed, from what I heard yesterday. But I think they're listening to political aides who say, well, look, we're getting close. Don't alienate people. You know, as Frederick Douglass said, and you've said many times, I'm sure, on your show, power concedes nothing without demand. It never has and it never will. Well, they weren't really making a demand. They were trying to get a bill into a law. We need to lay down some demands.
Well, Jamie Cord, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamie Cord, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's the co-author of Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health, and his latest book, The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit, has just come out. And again, there's still time to get to the Isley Hammer Forum in Westwood tonight at 7:30 p.m. that I'm moderating 9/11, the Saudi connection with Senator Bob Graham and Robert Baer. Senator Bob Graham is the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and co-chair of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He'll be joining us to shed light on the Saudi role exposed in the 28 pages of the 9/11 report that remain classified. And joining him is former CIA veteran Robert Baer, the author of Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Again, tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, free and open to the public. Join me for 9/11, the Saudi connection with Senator Bob Graham and Robert Baer. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.